How's that?
It's acceptable.
But I'm talking right into the microphone.
It's acceptable. Well, you want better than acceptable? Please. I think you hold your standards way too high.
It's like, what was it someone was talking about? You know, they've got various levels of, you know, your meat can be choice or prime or something like that. And they were talking about they worked at, you know, Taco Bell or somewhere, and the meat came in labeled as fit for human consumption. I mean, I'm just saying, acceptable is kind of the lowest standard.
Your voice is coming across acceptable for human listening.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I have on the line today my good friend, Professor Alan Middleton. And I say good friend because I had him muted for a moment, and he couldn't complain that with the lack of reality to that statement.
You know,
how are
good,
you, Professor Alan?
Good, friend, let's go with adequate acquaintance. How about that? Okay.
Adequate for human consumption. I think they would gladly serve my ground meat as a Taco Bell.
Well, it is fair to say I believe you would be in the top five of buddies I know on the internet who I haven't met in real life yet.
Who live in Long Island.
Who live in Long Island and are lawyers and are older than me. Of that group. No, I mean,
I'm at least in the top five.
I mean, I'm not going to say whether Derek Crabb is above or below you. I'm just saying you're both on the list, okay?
And that's important. You know, I'm a sports fan, and I believe you are as well.
Oh, yes.
And I'm a Mets fan, and I'm a Yankees hater.
Okay.
Now, the Yankees happen to be one of the distinguishing things about them is I believe they are the most popular and the most hated team in baseball across the country.
We would call them the Dallas Cowboys of baseball.
Yes.
Or the Cowboys Yankees of football.
To create the analogy, I suspect that I might be on the top five list of podcasting friends, and I also might be on the bottom five list as well.
You're saying there aren't that many podcasting friends.
Well, podcasting friends who you have not met.
See, that's true.
Because quite frankly, you paired me off with Derek Crabb, and I believe I've seen a photo of you and Derek Crabb in the same place at the same time.
Nope.
I think
nope,
there was
nope.
I thought you guys were at was it Hero? Nope. Not Heroes Con.
Not me and Derek. He is still on the list. He's still on the list.
Okay. Yep, but I know you have gone to several events where you've met with people.
Yep.
So I suspect that the list of people you have not met personally is not that long.
I'm working on it. And here, not to bring us down, but every time this topic comes up, I have to say it was our good friend, the late Sean Engel, that really gave me the impulse, me and M, to get out and meet people. And
yes, I agree totally. I have the same exact feeling.
Yeah, and so I am whittling down that list. It is possible that you might have to get out of New York to make this happen. But
Heroes I have Con successfully in Charlotte.
Yeah.
And I've talked to one of my buddies about going to that this coming year, and I was talking to Darren and Ruth and mentioned to them that I might be going. And that one usually seems like a good receptacle for podcasters.
Yes. And it is a comic, almost exclusively con. in terms of the merchandise and the guests who are there and all of that. You don't have to wait through the lines of people to see the TV stars and the voice actors and the movie this and the it's comic related. Baltimore, yeah, so a little bit closer to you would do that as well. I've tried to get up a couple of times to visit Ange up in the New England. I know he likes the Connecticut. What's that?
The Terrificon.
Terrificon and Wicked-Con.
I've heard good things about that.
Yeah.
In fact, I think a lot of creators go to that because of the location. I think they're enthusiastic.
Yeah.
So, there's two points that I have on my mind. And the first one is going to kind of, I'm going to make the first one, and then we're going to go to the second one, and then we're going to get back to the first one.
Oh, my life.
But, you mentioned.
This sounds like one of my lectures. Okay.
You mentioned that I'm older than you. And the reality is I am. But not by that much. And I find it interesting that when you and I podcast together, being among the elder statesmen this particular group, that we usually pick books that are far younger than our ages. And that will be demonstrated as we discuss our books.
Absolutely.
In a little while.
Absolutely. Well, I love the way this works out is you invite me. I send you my selection, and then you turn it into a themed episode in some way. So that is, it is almost always in your response that we develop a bit of a theme. I remember once I did Spider-Man and Sandman, and you did the Jack Kirby Sandman. To me, yes, that was one of your best moves. I'm going to say that one was pretty good.
Come on. Well, again, it's not a tough hurdle to get to be one of my best moves. I have many moves that do not make that list. So in today you picked a Spidey Super Stories. So in response to that, I decided it would be good to pick a book of also for younger people. And mm-hmm. again, we'll get to that in a moment. But you mentioned in passing that your book cost 50 cents. Seems like utter insanity to me.
Well, first off, I save the 25 cent ones for, let's just say, for a different show, Paul. Okay. I'm not going to look, I wouldn't say it would be a waste to cover a quarter book here. It would just be inefficient for my podcasting purposes. Okay.
Yeah, no, I understand.
I said 50 just cents at most. It's possible it was free. Okay. It's possible someone.
But
gave
then,
it to
then
me.
it would be acceptable fodder for the other show.
See, oh man,
because that show, if I understood criteria correctly, it's cost at most 25 cents.
That's right. That's right. I'm thinking about moving that up to, three for a dollar because of inflation since I started 11 years ago. So what's the dollar equivalent of 25 cents from?
It's hard. It's hard now to find even a good dollar bin.
Yeah.
And I have to say, and this leads us into the second part of what I was going to say. I have my want list of books that I would like to obtain to complete collections or just that I want for whatever reasons. And I have been much more active buying books in the last, say, 3 years than I had been for quite a while. And I have been able to find a very large number of my lower priced books, the $1 and $2 books on that list. Yep. So now the list is starting to become quite costly when I do pick up a book.
I've heard these episodes of Bins where you've talked about the 5 and 10 plus, in some cases, multiple. 20, 30, it seems like, to fill some.
And I, there's certain books that I have just a totally hard time. There's certain ones I understand. If I want to get an Amazing Fantasy 15, I understand that's a costly item. And I understand why it's a costly item. But when they say you know, oh, issue 43 of this is worth, you know, $250 because it's the first appearance of Joe Blow. It's like, do people really want to pay that much money for this? And I'll even be more specific to, rather than just give a hypothetical, like the first appearance of Blade is ridiculously expensive.
Yep. Yep.
The first appearance of Thanos, ridiculously expensive. Yep. The first appearance of Moon Knight, ridiculously expensive. Now, I understand that those books price higher than the books that surround it on the list, but to price as high as they do just boggles my mind.
Yeah. I've become a little more, I mean, I don't want to blow my reputation here, but I have also become a little more aggressive about plugging the holes in my collection. And part of that, I don't want to get too morbid, but you know, there's a limited amount of time for me to do this. And I'm starting to feel that a little bit. And it's not just, I'm not just talking mortality. I'm talking about ability and interest and attention, ability to focus and attention to detail. And I've got no problem also crawling around, you know, on a cement floor to dig through boxes. It's the standing up that's sometimes a problem. I have no problem sitting down, and I will even slide from box to box, but I need a little help standing up.
I need a little stool or something to sit on. I've hit a point where going down on my knees is just not, you know, not recommended by my orthopedist.
There was one store that had a, you know, a low, you know, rolling desk chair that they would either leave out, or they might do a little age profiling and decide who might need that, which you I know appreciate. What
I find the dynamic changes a little bit. Like when they have a show not far from here. It's every third Sunday of the month, and it's purely a comic thing. You know, it's one room. You know, it's not a huge room, but it's one room, and there's, I don't know how many dealers there are, but there's, you know, quite a few. So now I'm finding, because the cheap bins don't hold too much of what's on my list anymore. Yeah. I do search through them for the things that are on my list, but you know, I'm not going to come away with 50 books anymore. I may come away with 6 from there. And then if I buy one or two of the more pricey items, let's say $30 books, and I walk out of there having spent more money than I would have in the past, and I have 7 books in my hand, and that as opposed to 50.
Yeah,
and I find, you know, the cost per book ratio.
Talking my language, disturbing. Buddy.
It's disturbing. Now,
I have to tell you this. It is very possible that I recently spent more on a single comic than I ever have before. It's possible. Because I've been doing this long enough in my life, I don't actually remember the price of everything I may have bought. But it was at my LCS over Labor Day weekend. And they had the last book that was missing in my run of Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. The Legion took over in 197, and it ran through 259 under that name.
Right.
And I was missing issue 205. And I've been picking away it's a giant size.
No.
It's a giant size, like a low run, whatever reason. It was the last one on the list, and you know, I picked out, you know, plucked other ones recently at $3 or $4 or $5, whatever it is, and this one was still there. But there it was in the back issue bins at World's Greatest Comics. Now, I don't want you to panic. It had a price tag of $14. Now wait, it was Labor Day weekend, and it was a 25% off sale.
Thank God.
So it was only $10.50.
And still the most expensive book you've ever bought.
that I can remember. but it might not be for long. That's the problem. It might not be for long.
But this is why you are on in my Hall of Heroes. Because
if you didn't limit yourself to those New York inflated prices, get out of your bubble on occasion, got to the inexpensive Midwest.
Let's just say that there are a couple, not many, trust me, a couple of books that I have actually spent three figures on.
Yeah, I can't see that happening for me.
It amazes me that it's happened. And the thing is, I can't, I've tried to complete my runs of certain books, like, just to use one as an example, Daredevil. And my run of that book is, I limit it, you know, as I've talked about on the show before. I'm looking to get from the beginning to issue 200. I don't care about anything past 200.
Yeah.
I am now down to three books that I need. But it is issue 1, issue 2, and issue 16, which guest stars Spider-Man.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
And I believe it's the first time John Romita ever drew Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So they are all in excess of what I want to pay. Now, I have found issues. I don't believe that I have spent anything above two figures on the ones that I've obtained. Some of them are in the higher two figures.
Right.
Like issue 7, I think, was, I'm speculating, I don't remember, but I think that may have been like $75. But for that issue, I think that was a very fair price.
Right.
Issue 3 was probably about $60, I believe. And it's in very good condition. So, I mean, I am willing to break the Professor Allen standards. But it hurts me every time. But especially, as, you know, as we are among the older generation of this, knowing how inexpensively I could have gotten some of these books back in the day.
I know. I have a couple of things on that one. Like I said, when I got this issue of the Legion, I picked up three or four others, and I walked out of there, I spent $24.
On
five books. It's like, oh.
But
books and that
spending over $10 on one.
That's true. You bring down the average.
This way you bring down the average to $4 or $5 each, and it's not so bad.
And the problem is that $24, one of my other Grail books was there. Warlord number one for $10. And I said, I can't buy two $10 comics, can I? And now I'm thinking, I got to go back next month. So at least it hits a different credit card bill, right? Can I do that? At least can I go back a month later, see if it's still there. But one thing that tricked me up on your notion of, I liked it, of setting the boundaries. And then I know you've talked about that. I do this as well. In some of our collections, you work backwards. You know, you've maybe wherever you started, now you're filling in backwards. And for me, one of those ones is Iron Man. And I think when I started the project, I may have started around number 142 or something like that, up to over 300. Now, one thing I need to do is I need to get rid of the ones past, I think I have through 313. That's just an unsatisfying number. So probably need to get rid of those last 13, but.
Yeah, and I have up to 300 is my cutoff.
Yep, exactly. So what you're saying is you would love to have 301 through 313 show up at your... Okay, I understand. Good. Got it. Okay. Message received, buddy. Merry Christmas to Paul.
Now, on Iron Man...
Let me say that, because I'm working backwards. And I've gotten to about 130. The problem was, I noticed that I think that's about where I'm going to stop. Because I think Demon in the Bottle, the first run, is around 127, and that's like an $80 book. So it's like, okay, I know
for cover price, whatever that was.
So you're saying you'll trade me for 301 through 313? Trade me. So I'm pretty. So I think I'm done with my Iron Man collection. Like, I've gone back as far as I can affordably.
See, and now Iron Man,
no need to break the bank to.
Iron Man, I am down to six issues that I would need to fill my run from issue one to issue 300. The problem is, five of those six issues I think I will find at a reasonable price. The sixth issue is number 55, which I don't think I'm going to, unless I go to like a garage sale or something. I'm never going to find that. I'm never going to find that from somebody who knows about comic books
at a
reasonable price.
So, well, as I always said, you occasionally, some of our buddies online who go to thrift shops and find comics. I've never found comics at Goodwill or at a thrift shop or anything like that.
I've tried.
And I haven't had really good luck at garage sales either. To me, the best luck I've had finding stuff where they don't know what it is would be a used bookstore, that has some comics in it, because they don't know that, miscellaneous book from whatever it is should be a $10 book, not a 50 cent book or whatever.
Yeah. But, I'll try and, we'll pass a garage sale and I'll say, oh, we're going to stop. And you see, you can hear my wife's eyes rolling, but still she indulges me.
Yes. And if you found something, she would encourage you to buy it, even if it's a little bit outside your price range. I love those stories.
She would encourage me to buy it, and then she would complain that I have too many comic books. Because we do have to sit on both sides of that fence.
Yep. I mean, part of my thinking is, we've got my father passed away a couple of years ago. Father-in-law, he's moved into a different location of his facility. So we've had more downsizing and more stuff in my house. And my joke now is that with the stuff we've gotten from those two households, I will never have to buy a postage stamp, a Christmas card, pens, Sharpies ever again.
That's what my kids are going to say when I go.
That's the thing. I mean, the nice thing is M will know what to do with the comics.
Yes, that is a plus.
And won't get ripped off. So that's helpful. But a lot of this other junk.
Yep. But so as I've said so many
put
times.
Me into a little bit into downsizing mode a little bit. Not so much on the comics. Let's not go crazy.
Well, as I've said so many times, I could downsize more than I have. I could eliminate comics. I could get rid of them. But then all I'm doing is saying, well, I'm going to die soon, so let me get rid of this stuff. Yeah. I enjoy having them. And if I enjoy having them until I croak, then my kids are going to have to deal with that.
Yeah. But I have tried to be a little intentional about looking through my collection and saying, do I really need this? Like, do I need those Iron Mans after 300? No. Do I need all of these miscellaneous one-shot black and white independent books I bought when I was in college in the 80s?
Absolutely. Some of them are...
That is not the right answer, Paul. I came to this support group for a totally different. So I am trying to be trying to let go what I don't want to more treasure what I do have. How about that?
That seems fair.
And like I always say, anytime comics go out of the house, Mrs. Quarterman knows that. Like they're stacked up on the kitchen table, or make sure she knows. But comics that come into the house, Paul, she doesn't need to really worry about those much. That's not as big a deal.
What's probably a little amazing to her is she sees these comics going out, and yet room where they're kept keeps getting more and more filled. It's like the loaves and the fishes. But it's all good. Mrs. Binns is very much an enabler, so. I can't
Nothing
complain.
Wrong
she's,
with
she's,
that. Nothing
she's
wrong.
You know, I've been doing for a while now. I've been doing my rebagging and reboarding project.
Yep.
And
that's got to be next summer for me. Yep.
It takes. I mean, it's a slow process because I have about 9,000 books.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's pricey to get all the bags and boards. And I'm figuring this is a one-time thing.
Yeah.
This is the last set of bags and boards these comics are getting while under my stewardship.
Because I know in some cases for me, they've been in them 30-plus years.
Yeah, so, same thing for me.
Yeah.
And so I started, you know, my collection is, it's broken down alphabetically, but it's also separated. It's alphabetically Marvel, then it's alphabetically DC, and then it's everything else, whatever that might be. And I would say Marvel is easily 2/3 of my collection.
Right.
And so going through it alphabetically, I was just working yesterday on my Power Man and Iron Fist books. So that's how far I've gotten to this point.
That's good. That's good.
My wife offered to help, but the problem is she offered to help with the part that I don't want help with. I would love to just have her put the boards in the bags for me.
Right.
She doesn't want to do that. She wants to help take them out of the old bags, put them in the new bags.
Right.
That's the part I enjoy because I get to look at the book handle it and all of that. Mm-hmm. So the last guy says, well, you could do this. And if looks could kill. You wanted to do this. Well, yeah, this is my hobby, so that's fine.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And as I do tell Mrs. Quarterbin that there are people we know that have more expensive hobbies, that have rebuilding a sports car in the garage or around here, travel to every Ohio State away football game and have season tickets for the home games. And, you know,
or gamble or go out to bars.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my hobby can be measured in quarters. That does help. That does help.
And this aspect of the hobby, the podcasting part of it is virtually free. I mean, every once in a while I indulge in a new set of headphones or a microphone or something, but there's really no significant expenses tied to this particular hobby. So, it's just time.
And Mrs. Quarterbin even appreciates that I talk to my little comic book buddies every now and then. She sees that actually as a positive thing for a man of my age to have some friends that I can talk to.
My wife does too. But sometimes when the sessions go on exceptionally long
and Scott is involved,
then she's like, well, you know, you were gone for 3.5 hours. How much could you have to talk about, you know? It's like, well, what can I tell you? Scott is long-winded.
But I do have to say that I've enjoyed this run of bins the last year or so with Scott coming back, being a much more active participant, regular participant in the show. I've enjoyed that. I like all the miniseries you've got going. You know, I was kind of worried you wouldn't be able to squeeze me in with all the other stuff you're doing. But
well, if we keep gaining weight, we're not going to squeeze in anything.
Anywhere.
We'll always find the time for our former intern.
That's right. There you go. See,
intern made good. So let's talk about some comics now. You want to do yours first, or you want to do mine first?
I can go. I can go first. I mean, I did pick mine first.
You did.
And it is the Marvel. That is right. That is right. So I am covering the Marvel this time, though technically it is a co-production between the House of Ideas and the Electric Company, because that's right. It's a Spidey Super Stories, issue 14, cover dated December 1975. Now, do want to say that I was aware of the Electric Company when I was growing up, but I think I was a little too old, older than some of our buddies for whom this is their introduction to Spider-Man. Right.
Yeah.
Same is true for me. Yeah. I would assume that you were also not a viewer of the Electric Company back in the day.
I did get in on the very, very beginning of Sesame Street.
Right.
Because I think that started around 68.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Right. And that would have put me at 5 or 6 years old. Right. So I was there for that.
Yeah.
But Electric Company, I think, started probably around 72, 73, maybe somewhere around there. And by then I was in double digits. So that wasn't happening.
Yep. So some of our buddies with less life experience, let's go with that, have a much more nostalgic toward the Electric Company and Spidey Super Stories as well. But this cover by John Romita shows Shanna, not Shanna the She-Devil, but just Shanna, swinging on a jungle vine with Spidey swinging at her via his webs. They're swinging above a deep hole, a pit, and Shanna's vine has snapped. In addition,
reminiscent of Gwen Stacy's neck.
That is probably the exact reference Romita was going for in this kid's story. Good call. Good call, Paul. Good call.
I do believe there was a snap sound effect.
I think that is correct.
And perhaps Mr. Romita felt left out because Gil Kane had drawn that story and decided, you know what, I'm going to get in on this.
I need a snap.
That's, you think it's the vine, it's Shanna's neck.
In addition to proclaiming that Shanna teams with Spidey in this issue, the cover also tells us that Easy Reader says that this comic is easy to read. So I thought the cover worked. It gives us the setting. It gives us the guest star and even a bit of drama, although a bit of exaggerated drama from the twisted mind of Paul Spatero. But what else could you ask for? What do you think of the cover?
I think it's very well drawn. And right off the bat, this, the artwork on the cover and within the book immediately brings me back to the feeling from the Spider-Man daily strip in the newspapers.
Oh, okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the feel it gives me.
Yeah.
So, you know, a simplified, nice, clean version, but well drawn just the same.
There are three stories in here. We're only going to cover one of them, this cover story with Shanna. But I do want to mention in passing the other two. One wasn't bad, with a vampire theme, a lighthearted vampire theme, of course, given the nature of the title. The other story featured the Birthday Bandit as the villain, based on a story from an actual Electric Company skit. And I have to say, that one was not good. To put it in a context that you'll understand, Paul, and many longtime listeners will, I'm not saying that specific story was at Apollo Smile level, but it was certainly in F Troop range, if you know what I'm saying. Okay. But the,
I got you. And I cringe to think.
But the one we are covering is 11 pages, The Trapper, written by Gene Thomas with art by Wynn Mortimer, Mike Esposito, and Tony Mortallaro, or Motolaro, depending if he's depending where he's from. And that is Gene Thomas, wife at the time of Roy Thomas. And we start with an actual sort of splash page introducing the story. Spidey and Shanna fight to escape the Trapper. It all began when Peter Parker entered the city science contest. Of course, he wins the contest and earns a trip to Africa to hear a world-famous animal expert speak. That expert, of course, is Dr. Shanna O'Hara, who was talking about saving animal life. Peter thinks it's too good to be true. And since this is a kiddie comic, too good to be true means that Shanna is a famous expert on all things animal, and Peter is all about that science. Now, if this were a teen plus or above comic, he would be excited because Shanna is, you know, a lovely blonde jungle woman, and in later years, lovingly drawn often by Frank Cho. Hubba, hubba. Dr. O'Hara talks about jungle animals that are in danger from people who hunt them and steal them. And as she goes to introduce the audience to a one-of-a-kind white elephant. Oh no, the elephant is gone. Somebody stole him. This is no longer a job for Dr. O'Hara, she proclaims, whipping off her lab coat. No, seriously. And revealing the jungle print outfit beneath. This is work for Shanna. Shanna, queen of the jungle, not the she-devil. And while all attention is on Shanna, Peter slips away because something tells him this might also be a job for Spider-Man. Shanna tracks her prized white elephant, but realizes that she's being followed by Spidey. And they team up, although she finds it pretty funny to think that Spidey is going to try to help her there in the jungle. But okay. We learned that they are not up against just a trapper, but it's the trapper with capital letters. So you know he's important. Not the trapster, who Peter has gone up against a number of times at this point. This is the trapper, the most evil hunter of all. He catches rare animals, takes them away, then he sells them. Soon all the wild animals will be gone. And we learn that Spidey has been here before in this location and back in Spidey Super Stories number 2. And because of that experience, Shanna allows him to continue to hang out with her and help. They end up catching the trapper in his own trap, a pit he prepared for the white elephant, and he's turned over to the game warden. Then Dr. O'Hara continues her talk, but Pete has fallen asleep. In his defense, he just helped capture a very bad hunter after traveling halfway around the world and is understandably a little bit tired. The white elephant squirts Peter with water out of his trunk, and Shannon proclaims that her friend Spider-Man could teach Peter to never let his guard down. The end. Now, as a Marvel man, Paul, you must have run across stories with Shanna plenty of times.
Yes, absolutely. I was first introduced to Shanna when I, very, very early in my comic collecting phase, because she was guest starring in an issue of Daredevil, which was around issue 110, I believe. I think my first issue of Daredevil was 109, and I think it actually ends the final, you know, the final splash page at the end of it is Shanna walking into the room, and then she's going to be, you know, joining him on his adventure. If I remember correctly, I could be misremembering slightly, but I don't think so. And then I really enjoyed when they came out with Kazar the Savage.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's when he and Shanna actually got married. Yep. And what I found fun about that was, you know, they titled it Kazar the Savage, and it was the most civilized Kazar that I, you know, that you ever saw in comics. He's, you know, he no longer had the, you know, me Kazar, you Shanna, Tarzan way of speaking, and, you know, was talking very, very very city oriented or whatever.
Sophisticated, you know. And I always liked, I mean, that is a take on Tarzan that I like. Because in the Edgar Rice Burroughs novels, Tarzan was an educated, or became an educated, sophisticated English gentleman. And so he would spend time in London. Usually Jane would prefer him to live that upscale, upclass city life, but the call of the jungle would pull him in. And it's really the Johnny Weissmuller movies and then other movies that sort of present Tarzan as having that simple, staccato, single syllable speech pattern. But that isn't necessarily the way he was originally portrayed. So Kazar really tries to rip off all elements of Tarzan at once. And I don't own any Kazar, but I've read a decent amount, and that is certainly where I've run across Shanna before and find her to be an enjoyable character.
I think I have I could be wrong because I've never done a search to see if I'm missing anything, but I think I probably have all of Kazar's silver and Bronze Age appearances.
And I was
modern ones, not so much.
I was doing a little bit of research, and Shanna the She-Devil from that title came out 72 or so, along with Night Nurse, and there was another. No, they did, you know, three female-led the cat. Yeah, three female-led.
Beware the claws of the cat.
That's right. That's right. And certainly of the, although, you know, Night Nurse was a TV star for a while. Certainly Shanna is the one that, pardon the pun, has had the most legs over the last 50 years in terms of turning into an ongoing character.
I have, of the five issues of Shanna's series, I am missing one.
There you go.
I do have the run of Beware the Claws of the Cat. I do not have any Night Nurse issues.
God.
And since the Netflix series where she appeared, those are probably ridiculously expensive based upon what they are. Right. So I don't think I'll be obtaining those. But I've always found Shanna to be an entertaining character. I'm trying to remember. They gave her an interesting backstory. I think her father was killed, and she kind of left society and became the She-Devil.
She did have veterinary training originally.
Yes.
So I do like that. Obviously, this is such an abridged and compressed, you know, version of Shanna. At least, you know, the basics are in continuity.
I find it interesting that she is such an animal whisperer that she manages to get what I believe is a gazelle and an alligator to hang out together in a straw area.
Oh, yeah.
And then she's got a monkey.
I like the monkey with a sling. Yeah,
was kind of hanging out, looking miserable because on doctor's orders he's not allowed to swing around. I mean, and you got to remember this is a book for children. However, I don't know if it's the best message to give children. Oh yes, alligators—they can be domesticated.
Yeah,
I don't know that I want to give that message.
That's fair. I mean, the phrase "world famous veterinarian" also is just a little. I'm not sure that I mean, unless you're on TV, I guess.
Yeah, and I was just going to say
TV shows. So
I was just going to say, in the modern era of social media, it's possible for a veterinarian to gain world fame.
That's true.
Back in the 1970s, I don't think that really was a thing, unless you could talk about Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom,
right?
Something along those lines. But I'm not so sure that they're saying she had a TV series. Yeah. I don't know why she's world famous.
Yeah,
she's the Dr. Ruth Westheimer of animals.
Now, I have to say, generally speaking, I'm not a fan of superhero nicknames like Soups and Bats. But I have to say, that's exactly old Shellhead. But of these shortened nicknames, especially Spidey is absolutely the best. That's the exception. It just works, at least to my ears, the way that Bats or Soups really doesn't. Some of these
other ones can rub me the wrong way.
Spidey, it just fits.
There's one that works for me, but it only works for me coming out of the mouth of one character. And it's when the thing calls Reed Richards Stretcho.
Stretch. Yeah.
I'm good with that.
Yeah. Okay. I'll allow that.
I don't want to listen to anybody else calling him that.
Right. Right. But Spidey. Spidey just works. So.
So
I do like the fact that they were actually able to, do a kid-friendly version of Shanna. In the 70s, she wasn't. I mean, I was gonna say, I didn't think she was that wild looking, but I'm sure she was wearing a bikini and was a little more provocative than she is here. But the fact that they were able to tone her down just enough is interesting approach.
I think in the 70s, yeah, I mean, it may have been a bikini instead of a one piece. But beyond, and I'm not even 100% sure about that. I'd have to look at those issues because I can't say it's burned into my mind, which maybe it should be, but you know, whatever.
You know, Paul, the problem is it may once have been burned into your mind.
Could be.
That's what I'm learning.
Yeah, that is a good point. But I don't think she was ever portrayed particularly provocatively through the 70s, maybe later.
Yeah.
I think if anyone, you know, Black Widow was a little bit more provocatively presented. Right. I think we covered an issue of was it an Astonishing Tales that she had the split with, or was it that or Amazing Adventures? I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It was one of them that she had the split book for a while. And there's a scene by I think it's by Gene Colan where she's showering and you kind of get a silhouette of naked Black Widow. And, you know, for a 12-year-old, that's pretty sexy stuff.
Whoa.
Anyway, onto more office-friendly fodder. I got a kick out of this. I had to read it with the perspective of who is the intended audience for this.
Yeah.
And for a young kid, it is... You know, I'm sure it's a very entertaining story. I kind of wish they had given you just a little bit more feel for the animals if you're trying to educate a young kid.
True. Right.
You know, it seems like the only message is trapping animals is wrong.
Right.
No matter what those animals might be. But I kind of wish they had given you just a little bit more of a feel for, you know, maybe an endangered species. In specifically, I mean, not that you see too many white elephants around, but you know, they didn't really give you too much on that. Oh, and I'm just looking now, on the page where she kicks the trapster into his own trap, the trapper, excuse me, I said,
yes,
trapster.
No,
at the top of that page, there's a shot of the elephant, and you could see it has a bandage on its ear.
Oh, my.
And then, yeah, on following pictures, I hadn't noticed that before. Yeah,
that's funny. No.
But, you know, overall entertaining.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's comics by their nature are about limitations, about a set number of panels, a set number of words in those panels. And when you're doing a story like this, those limitations are even greater. The panels are bigger. So there are fewer on each page. There's really at most maybe two speech bubbles per panel. And the letters are a little bit bigger. So they're a little, you know, you've far fewer words and far fewer images that you have to tell your story. And it is a globe trotting epic. So.
I always questioned when, you know, Spider-Man would go on a trip, you know, actually, excuse me, let me back that up, when Peter Parker would go on a trip, and it would just happen that Spider-Man was there too. Like, you know, did anybody notice this? This happens a lot. Everywhere Peter goes, Spider-Man happens to be there. Huh.
I mean,
I'm coming to the conclusion these two might be friends.
Now, at the end, you know, we do get a little bit of a wink from Spider. But from Pete, when Shanna says, you know, my friend Spider-Man could teach you to never let your guard down. So, I mean, she knows, right? I mean, obviously she knows.
And the look on his face, to me, the look on his face is almost the George Reeves Clark Kent.
Yes, exactly. There you go. Perfect.
He's winking at the camera.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
you want to rate it?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, I was going to say, I think it did what it was intended to do, like you say. In terms of the cover, since this story is the cover story, mention the cover. I mean, it's not going to go in John Romita's portfolio, the application to be in the Cartoonist Hall of Fame, but It does what it needs to do. And the additional Gwen Stacy reference that I can now not get out of my mind. I mean, it manages to really up the drama a little bit here. So it's a solid B for a cover. That's fine. The story, I think the story works well. We said for the intended audience, stories about animals always tug at the heartstrings of kids. And a veterinarian who's a hero, who's also a strong heroine, saving the day. I think there's a lot of positive public television imagery and messaging there. So that works. Bits of humor as needed. Like I said, this story alone by far is the strongest of the three. And judging it just as a story for what it is, I think it's a B plus. I think it works. I think it works well. And like those little bits of, I guess it's story and art, like you said, the presence of the bandages and the slings on the animals, very interesting. And interior art, I do think it's an achievement to take a stereotypical Jungle Girl character and present her in a responsible, kid-friendly way. So just on those grounds, I think the art is impressive. And I have to say, thinking about a kid's book, I was expecting to find, I was looking for some skimping, like maybe on the backgrounds or that sort of thing, some shorthand. But certainly the jungle scenes are very full and lush. So, I don't know that shortcuts, were taken artistically, for the audience. I think it's clean, easy to follow. It's on the simple side, of course, but there's only so high that I could go with the rating, but it's a B. So it's a high B overall. Again, having read all of the stories, it's more like a low B because there are some lower quality work that we're not covering. So somewhere in that range, I would say.
All right. I'm not really in disagreement with you. I think the cover is a solid picture. I like the fact that since Spider-Man is on the logo and Spider-Man is in the corner box and Spider-Man is on the cover, you didn't need to have him as the biggest character on the cover.
Oh, right.
Good and point, you were right. Able to have the guest star kind of take that role because there's no doubting this is a Spider-Man book. He's represented yeah. very well in there. So now we're giving you a little something extra by showing you, that we have this guest star here. Why John Romita feels like rubbing it in everybody's face that Gwen Stacy's neck snapped, I don't know. And unfortunately, John is no longer with us, so we can't ask him why he was so vindictive about this.
Yeah, that man clearly had issues. I see your point completely.
But I think this is something I could easily see if somebody came to him, when he was around and wanted a commission and said, give me a Spider-Man and Shanna. And I think he'd pump this out. I have seen video of John drawing, and he was extremely fast, at least, initially. Yeah. I could see him pumping this out with no problem at all. He had a sense of layout that I think was beyond what most people do. So I think that's what made it a little easier for him. And then he just had such a clean style.
Yeah.
That, when I was first reading comics in general, and I started going into back issues, and for the most part, my Spider-Man back issues were reprints at that time because I couldn't afford to get those really early ones. But I was reading some Steve Ditko books and I had read some Gil Kane books. And by far, Romita had the most comfortable art style to read as a kid. Right. I grew to appreciate Ditko and Kane much, much more so as I got older. But Romita, right from the start was very comfortable for me. And the good thing about it is it's not like, okay, he was comfortable when I was young because he was simple and then I got older and I outgrew it. I never outgrew John Romita. Yeah. His artwork is still Among he's still one of my all-time favorites. In no question at all, he's in my top three with Kirby and Neil Adams. That is my top three, and in whatever order you want to put them in.
And I liked your analogy to the newspaper strips. I think that's very apt.
Which he did do the newspaper strips for a while as well.
That's right. Yeah.
The story, it's, you know, it's simple, it's fun. Like I said, I kind of wish they had given you a little bit more, you know, a little bit more educating you on the animals, because the idea is to educate kids with these books.
Right.
So I think they could have done a little bit more with that. But other than that, you know, it's a simple little romp and it's fun. So I think a B is a good grade for it. I think had they done a little bit more, they might have pushed it up to even an A for what it is. The interior art is a little bit more simple than what we got on the cover, and not quite as craftsmanship laden. I'm going to say a B minus on the interior art. It's still good. It still gets the point across. It's just not, you know, not at quite as high of a level. And Mike Esposito, you know, he was always good, but he always had a way of, you know, presenting a simple image. Yep. And I think his style fits this. So I'll say a B minus on that as well. And overall, the book's a B.
I think that's fair.
So taking your lead on this, I decided to go with a kid's book. And before I discovered my love of superhero books, I had a love of a lot of more simple books, Archie books and Harvey comics and, you know, Sad Sack and Richie Rich and things like that. And Richie Rich was always a favorite character. And looking back, it's like a little surprising that he would be. But I think it's just the wish fulfillment aspect of it that, you know, this rich kid who not only does he have the money to get anything he wants, but the way it's presented in the books, he gets things that are far more creative than what you would think of yourself. He has just every gadget possible. You know, it's just, again, you know, it's a fantasy world for a young kid to be reading this stuff. So I always enjoyed Richie Rich for that reason. And I did not have too many Richie Rich books among which to choose, but I picked Richie Rich Millions number 68, which has a November of 1973 date. It cost 25 cents.
Perfect.
The cover shows Richie and Cadbury, who was his butler, dressed in superhero costumes and tied to two poles, while a long fuse in the shape of a dollar sign burns on a barrel marked TNT. Now, I don't even know that Ted Turner had a network back then, but apparently he did. The copy on the cover states, "Flaming fuses. What's this? Richie and Cadbury? Superheroes?" If only I could do the Batman 68 voice.
That's right.
The story is titled 111 Strawberry Street. Part 1. Richie and Cadbury are dressed in super costumes, although unlike the cover, Richie's is more akin to Robin's costume. They are on their way to perform their adventure comedy play, Crash Man and Rippy, at the Crandall Street School. But Richie's father receives a phone call from Horace Hangnail, an old-time actor, asking that they visit him in his home. They all refuse, and Richie and Cadbury leave. However, there is a note on the car imploring them to visit him. They're not planning to acquiesce, but they encounter several detours that end up leaving them at the Hangnail residence. They express their annoyance and try to leave, but a fake background has them drive right through a painted scenery into a room where they're trapped. Hangnail then twirls his mustache for effect. Our two stalwart heroes rush through an open door, only to become ensnared onto two poles, as depicted on the cover. And Hangnail laughs as he lights a fuse on a barrel marked as gunpowder. Part 2. Foiled. So, with certain demise facing them, Richie comes up with a plan to stir up dust and cause the two of them to sneeze, in hopes that the breeze will douse the fuse. And extinguish it does, which brings Hangnail in. And as he bends over to assess the situation, Richie manages to give him a double derriere boot, causing him to get stuck between two other poles as Richie and Cadbury free themselves from their shackles. Cadbury races through a door only to find himself falling, but after he manages to scramble back into the room, Hangnail reveals that it was only a 5-foot drop, camouflaged to look like more. But he follows that by shoving our two erstwhile heroes into another trap. This time they find themselves strapped to a log heading towards a whirling saw blade. Richie tricks Hangnail into coming closer and pops a bubblegum bubble in his face, causing him to stumble backwards and bump into a control switch, which releases them. At this point, Cadbury has had quite enough and is ready to give Hangnail a good thrashing, when he reveals that this was all a joke, and that the explosive and saw weren't real. He just wanted to demonstrate that he could still act. But, still angry, Cadbury dumps a bucket of water on Hangnail, on his head, telling him that he can make believe that it didn't have water in it. And they leave.
And because it was all make believe and pretend, his defense attorney, Paul Spataro, was able to get him only 17 years in prison. Because this guy, come on, man, this is outrageous.
Because it was all make-believe, the fact that Cadbury had a heart attack and died while they were on the saw blade doesn't matter because it was make-believe.
That's the way the law works, right?
Crazy stuff. But I have a fondness for Richie Rich comics and, again, Sad Sack comics and Hot Stuff and Little Lotta and whatever other ones they had coming out at that time. I'm just trying to even think of what else there was. But when I see these in the store, every once in a while, I'll pick up one of them and I'll bring it home and I'll say that I bought it for my wife for her nostalgia, because she gets a kick out of the stuff she remembers when she was a kid. So it's like, yeah, these are your books.
That's right. That's right. You've podcasted about TV shows before, so you know the concept of the backdoor pilot, the episode of one show introduces a new character or new location, new situation. Mm-hmm. You're testing that concept to see if it's good enough for its own show. Well, this issue must have worked well enough. It's like 6 months later, the title Super Richie comes out. Ran 18 issues in which Richie and Cadbury reprised these roles as whoever they were. I can't remember their superhero names now, but Crashman and Rippy.
Yes, that's it.
So there you go. So it must have worked. Whatever we think, it must have worked.
And, you know, I get a kick. I've always gotten a kick out of the fact that, well, first of all, I'm just looking at the pages. I get a kick out of the fact that Richie's father looks exactly like Richie, only just in a grown man's body.
Yeah.
But I always got a kick out of the fact that Cadbury should be this stodgy person, and yet he totally takes Richie on every adventure and he's never the downer that he probably should be.
Right.
He's perfectly willing to play along, you know, and he's there in his superhero costume with his bowler hat. it's just great. And again, it's wish fulfillment for an 8-year-old.
Now, I think that this story, I think it could have been funnier. I think, the prime, even the adventurous kids stories at Tintin or the best of the Uncle Scrooge stories, they have plenty of moments of levity, if not outright jokes. To me, the funniest sort of joke, well, kicking the guy in the butt. Okay, I like that one. I liked giving him a swift kick, if you want to count that as a joke. But really, the only joke is the very end, you know, when he says, I hope you liked make-believe so much. Yeah, so I needed just a little more levity in between during the story. But if you're doing the adventurous version of the story, you want to figure out how to balance that. In the prior one, we did have Spidey making a few quips along the way. So
I think this story, I think this story may be a victim of the fact that they had to do numerous stories to put in the book. Yeah. Yeah. I think if you wanted to work some more humor into it, you probably needed about two or three more pages to play with.
Yep. Yep.
And I think it would benefit from that. I agree with you there. But then, again, we always have to think of the intended audience.
That's right.
They're not looking and saying, you know what? I'm hoping that 50 years from now, a couple of 60-year-olds will pick this up and just laugh their asses off.
True.
Again, because the intended audience, I don't think that this lacks for levity. It's not out and out humor. It's not make you laugh, but it's just fun.
But true. And one of the things that helped for me as the, I'm almost 60-year-old. Okay, Paul, let's get that straight. Okay. We're not two 60-year-olds.
When you average us
on
together,
average, we're two 60-year-olds.
When we average us together, you are 60.
But I did like the fact that during the in the layout of this issue, the story split into part one and part two, and in between them are two 1-page gag strips. So I at least got my moment of levity, you know, in between the two parts of the story. So that worked. But you know, it's just in general on Richie Rich, it's sort of it's an ongoing joke among some of our podcasting colleagues about how many Richie Rich comics were published certain months. And actually this month, it's actually pretty slim. It's only like 7 this month that are advertised. And the comment I once heard from a guy who managed a comic book store was that his theory was that Harvey would publish as many Richie Rich comics in a month as they had good jokes for the cover. You know, if artists submitted 6 funny gags, okay, we're doing 6 issues. If it was 11, it's 11. So even in the adventure, you know, title, we still had the secret dollar sign being hidden, you know, in terms of that was the shape of the fuse that had been lit.
Yeah, it's you know, again, I don't think Richie Rich comics as I remember them, because I can't say I've sat there poring over these at this point, but as I remember them, I don't think they were filled with, you know, knee slapping humor. I think it was more along the lines of irony that a preteen could get.
And they would often have an adventurous story like this. Maybe it was often, you know, thieves breaking into the Rich estate or something like that. And maybe there's a new, theft deterrent device that their scientist friend, inventor friend has figured out, or, you know, often there's a often something like that, but there is regularly some adventurous elements within a Richie Rich issue. So that is not out of the blue.
Yeah, adventurous, often with, and you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, he'd have all these gadgets and machines and things like that, and a lot of times those were the impetus for the for the adventure.
Yep.
But you know, it's funny that, you know, Richie Rich is presented, especially when he's in his normal clothes, as almost a little Lord Fauntleroy type character. Yeah. So you would think that would be seen as uncool by the intended audience.
Right.
And yet I don't remember ever thinking that.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, the only thing I've heard, that the theory floated in the last decade, that if you look at Casper, you know, Casper is the exact same body shape, head shape as Richie Rich, and that's the conspiracy theory that Casper is the ghost of Richie Rich. That's it.
Well, that's I find that to be a very fun theory. I don't
know.
There
was only a snap somewhere in this issue that could give us our much needed connection.
With what was his girlfriend's name? Gloria.
Yep.
Somehow, like, she starts falling and you have a little snap. So he's also Peter Parker.
But I do like that. I mean, we opened the conversation talking about the outrageous price of comics these days, both new, which we didn't mention, but the back issue ones that we're chasing. But I will tell you, if you find dollar bins or 50 cent bins, one store I go to has regular 50 cent bins, and they are full of these kids' books. I don't think there's a single issue of any of these that is collectible in any sense, which for me is a positive because they're all 50 cents.
Maybe like the very first issue.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you go back far enough.
First appearance ever of the character.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back far enough, and if you talk Uncle Scrooge, you know, at that point, you're probably, you could be getting into some collectible issues, but for the most part.
Yeah, I think it's a rare thing. I think for some reason, and I'm not sure why, I think those very, very early issues might be kind of collectible on Sad Sack. I don't know why, but well, he was introduced. Yeah, well, you know what? Absolutely.
I mean, if you go back far enough.
Because he's introduced in 1942.
40s, yeah.
I was
yeah.
thinking it was the 50s. So yeah. it's long enough ago that there's no question those would be collectible. Yeah. But you're not finding them in a 50 cent bin, and you're probably not finding them anywhere, frankly.
Yeah.
I don't imagine there's too many that have survived, because even back in the 40s, when there weren't too many people who were collectors, there would have even been fewer that were collectors of that type of book.
Right.
So, you know, one of the reasons there's so few of those Golden Age books is because there were not collectors,
right,
to speak of.
And whatever collectors there were young enough that they had mothers.
Who threw them out.
Who would occasionally throw them out.
And my dad insisted he had a copy of Action Comics #1 when he was a kid. We don't have any verifiable data on that, but I don't think he'd lie, so he certainly believes that he had one.
Did, yes.
whether or not his memory is accurate, who knows? We're talking, you know, 1938.
That's right.
So, but you know,
that's great.
These are definitely fun books to look back on, just for nostalgia. Now, like many older books, even the older superhero books, for me, it's like, okay, I can read one or two, and right. then I have to let it sit for months and months before I could look at another one, because they're just not, you know, that's not how I want to fill my reading time.
See, I love these, and I regularly will work in, again, because they're 50 cents. I have tons of them, and folks have given me, again, these inexpensive, you know, in some cases, you know, one step away from being recycled. You know, those comics mm-hmm. that fall apart in your hands, but it's okay because they aren't worth anything. So I read, you know, handful of kids' comics almost every week of some kind, Archie or whatever it is, Richie Riches or whatever. So that's fun.
So you're more of a big kid than I am.
Exactly.
Well, because you're younger than me.
See, way younger. Let's be honest. Yeah. Way younger.
If I mean, I'm in school, I'd be bullying you around.
I mean, the way I count it, we're in different decades. So we're like, you're like, must be 10 years older. You're in your 60s and I'm only in my 50s. But I've read, I keep track of the comics I've read. And here in the 2020s, I've read a few more than 60 Richie Rich verse comics. And this one, to be honest, is a little below average. Maybe because I was looking for funny. And the problem is, if you go through the rest of the issue, there are two other stories in here, and one of them features his mean cousin Reggie, and that was not very funny either. There's only like one funny, really funny story. out of the three. But again, I do think they got the action bits right, and I like the notion of this like spinning out into what would be the super Richie series of stories. Because almost no matter who you are in the, especially in this kid space, Archie did it, Disney did it with Super Goof. There's always some occasionally in the comic book realm, you have to introduce a superhero, even if it's just a pastiche or a reference or a joke on that concept. So this is the Richie Rich version of it.
True. Very good. Very true. So I guess we can rate this one. I think the cover is the best part of this story. Mm-hmm. I think it is a superior cover. Mm-hmm. And no pun intended with the super part. but it's like a solid B+. Yeah. I think this is it's again, as a kid, again, looking for the intended audience, I think it's very enticing to pick this up based on the cover. The interior art, it's typical Richie Rich comic. There's nothing about it that stands out as being really good. There's nothing about it that stands out as being bad. It's a simplistic art style of a cartoony character, or of all cartoony characters. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to just say, because it just does what it's supposed to do, it's a B. The story, I do agree with you, there could have been a little bit more humor to it. I think it would have been better if they had maybe taken away the two joke pages and added jokes to this story instead.
Yeah.
I think that might have been a plus for it. But the story, again, for a single digit reader, I think this is wish fulfillment and this is fun, and they get the bad guy, but nobody's ever really at risk. All of that put together, I think it's your typical, it's not superior, it's not bad. And again, I'm going to say a B for it. So overall, I'll give the book a B, and I'll just personally say a B+ for tickling that nostalgia.
There you go. Well, I agree with you on the cover. I like the look on both Cadbury and Richie's face. I think you get nice expressive there. You've got the hidden dollar sign. You've got the TNT getting ready to go. And like you said, the Richie Rich character in general is wish fulfillment in a way that Archie is not, or some of the other kids comics are not. Then when you throw on top of that the wish fulfillment of superhero, I mean, it's like this is like, catnip for kids of these this age, right? So I again agree, the cover's good. We've said B, high B, B+. That's fine. And again, also agree with you on the interior. It's tricky because the interior art is exactly what it should be. It is like perfectly on model. But does that make it for an A+? Right, it's perfect. It could not have done what it was intended to do probably any better. Right? It met every requirement that Harvey Comics had. So, when you do the job you're hired to do, whoever this anonymous artist is, right? How do you grade that? But on the other side, there isn't anything dramatic or noteworthy about it, right? So. You could argue it's A work. You could argue it's C work. That makes it B work. where you came down. Again, story. I needed a little humor. And since I read kid comics a lot more than you do, the nostalgia element was not what I needed from this. So maybe I'd go C+ or B- on the humor. So I'd go B, maybe a little on lower on the B side. Than you, but we're definitely in the same ballpark. I to say, even though I didn't necessarily love it as much as I've loved other Richie Rich books or kids books, it must have worked because we got a super Richie comic after the fact. So whatever I thought of it, it was successful by its very definition.
There you go.
Whether they intended it, whether they were planning the Super Richie book already and this was a preview, or whether they sent this out and waited to see what the feedback would be, whatever. But
it was, I don't know how much feedback they got.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know.
I don't think there was a lot of feedback to stuff like this.
Yeah.
So I guess that's it for these two issues. But before we sign off, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you?
Well, first of all, thank you, Paul, for inviting me again. It's always good to be back on the show. Anytime I see the Professor Cheapskate signal lighting up the skies over Bin's HQ, I am all for it. And, spoilers, but maybe next time we'll actually bring a hero comic book. I don't know. Because I think
Interesting concept.
I think the time before this, didn't we do the Honeymooners?
I think you're right.
That was in our recent past. And Jerry Lewis, I think that was in our recent past. So maybe.
That's one of the things I enjoy about having you on, frankly, is that we do some different things. I like to fluctuate once in a while.
There you go. Well, most of our work can be found at the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Over there, you can find the Quarter Bin Podcast, the main podcast on the show, Doom Speak, where we talk about the greatest hero in comics, Dr. Doom, and a few other shows over there as well. And as of recording this, I think episode 212 of the Quarter Bin is coming out, which means in about 6 months or so, we got to start thinking about the dramatic return of Paul Spiteri. Every 25 episodes, so
it's what I'm here for. It's what I live for.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Alan. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
Absolutely.
And thank you, everybody who indulged us by listening to this. And I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.